Shrink Wrap Radio number 751, Scott D. Miller, PhD, on how psychotherapy lost its magic.
And now it's time for Dr. Dave and Shrink Wrap Radio.
You're on the couch again with Dr. Dave. And Shrink Wrap Radio is playing on again. Yeah. It's all in your head. It's all in your head. Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My return guest today is Scott D. Miller, whom I interviewed way back in 2006 on episode number 66, about what works in psychotherapy. His pioneering work on that topic continues to this day. However, today's focus is on a provocative article by him that appeared in the Psychotherapy Networker, which was titled, How Psychotherapy Lost Its Magic. The sponsor for today's episode is Audible.com, the premier source for audio entertainment. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Scott D. Miller, welcome back to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thanks, David. It's great to be here again.
Yes, again, because you and I spoke back in 2006, if you can believe that. It was Shrink Wrap Radio episode number 66, and this is episode number 751, I believe.
Oh, my.
Yeah. So, and we spoke then about what works in psychotherapy. I had seen you give a presentation in person on that topic and was so impressed that I wanted to have you on the show. So now, these many years later, you're still passionately on the trail of what works in psychotherapy. And in the seminar that I attended, I remember being impressed by how sensible you were, how down to earth, and how devoted you were to scientific rigor. So imagine my surprise during a recent interview with psychotherapist and psychic Betty Friesen, when she's dropping your name in support of her psychic intuition and refers me to your article that appeared in Psychotherapy Networker, How Psychotherapy Lost Its Magic.
Yeah.
So I got all excited because I think I've long confused my listeners by pledging a certain amount of allegiance to the scientific method, yet insisting that it's not the whole story.
Yeah.
And I'm somebody who taught a course on parapsychology years ago. I've consulted a psychic. I've given some tarot readings for money. So you can imagine, I read your article and I thought, wow, here is a fellow traveler. So I really want to thank you for being here today. So let's get into it. So tell us about how your research on what makes psychotherapy effective, or how it can be effective, led to this. It led you into some unexpected corners.
Yeah.
You begin your article with a story of someone who felt driven to consult a psychic or spiritual reader. If you still recall that, maybe that's a good place for us to start.
There's a story of Abigail, who lost her daughter, who had been ill for many years, born with severe birth defects and anoxia, and lived with that daughter for, I think it was 20 or 21 years before she went into complete system or organ failure and died. And this is a a mom who not only loved her child, but ensured that she had as much of a life as any other American teenager and young adult could have, given her many disabilities, and felt at a loss because she had taken care of her for the two decades of her life. And what she really wanted to know was her daughter okay? So she sought out some therapists, as we talk about in the article, and she wasn't really satisfied. She even went to her minister and wasn't satisfied with the advice that she was given there. And it seemed that the therapist and the minister missed the point. She didn't want to work through her grief. She didn't want to accept God's will. She was quite concerned about whether her daughter was okay.
Even though she was dead, was she okay somewhere else somehow?
Yes. And I don't think that Abigail would say that her daughter was dead. She would say that she was no longer in a physical form,
okay,
but that she survived, and she just didn't have the ability or skill to make that particular connection, but believed in an afterlife, believed that we live beyond our mortal deaths as spiritual entities or energies. And in quite a chance conversation with somebody, I think while she was getting her hair done, mentioned somebody who had a special gift, and that was talking with the dead. We call that person Madeline. This is a real person. Both of these are a real person.
Yeah.
Her daughter was a real person who died. And she went to see Madeline, and Madeline, the experience with her resolved her core question. Was her daughter okay?
How did that get resolved? Did they have a seance?
They didn't have a seance. This is what you would call an open eye light medium, meaning that they perform in the light. There's no trumpets or tambourines or voices calling out of horns. This is somebody who sits, becomes quiet, and then tries to connect with people on the other side, or so she says.
Yeah.
And as soon as Abigail went in, she mentioned that, by the way, she'd given no information to Madeline about why she was coming to be seen, although she could probably guess, I suppose, that most people come to see her because they're trying to connect with somebody who's passed on. And she said, "You're here to talk about your daughter." This kind of shook Abigail.
Yeah, it starts with a hit.
Yeah, because there was no real information that was available or provided to Madeline ahead of time. And then she just begins to talk about her daughter and how she was doing in the life after this one.
Yeah. So that's the story that your article leads off with. Backing up a little bit here, you've been doing research on what makes therapy effective. How does that eventually lead you into the Madeline corner, if you will?
So our team has for many years pursued this question of what is it that works in therapy. So within the cultural context, Western cultural context of how to help people, we have psychotherapy to address mental, emotional, cognitive challenges and difficulties. And we noticed when we began measuring the outcomes of different clinicians that some consistently rose to the top. This is, by the way, the dirty little secret about our field. We've known for decades that some are better than others. We've had empirical evidence of this since a study published by David F. Ricks in 1974, where the people who were former clients labeled one of the clinicians in the sample a super shrink.
Yeah.
And I wanted to find out, in order just to improve my abilities and skills, well, what is it that they know and seem to be able to do? And as I said, I think therapists know that these folks exist. If you ask therapists just casually, do you know a therapist that you think is really good at what they do, probably a cut above the rest, all of them will say yes. Well, this person I'd send my family members to, that person I would not.
Yeah. And it's the same with doctors, right? With surgeons,
absolutely,
and so on, and
lawyers,
plumbers,
drivers, absolutely,
yeah.
And for most, I think concerns and issues that people have, seeing your average clinician is going to be perfectly acceptable. The overall outcome of psychological care is on par with or better than much of medicine. But my interest wasn't in that. My interest was in how could we help therapists push their performance to the next level. Mm-hmm. And as you know, the field of psychotherapy has its ideas about how to make that happen. First, you have to have a professional degree, then you have to have licensure, then you have to have postgraduate supervision. Then for the rest of your career, you have to attend continuing education. Now, I defy you or anyone to show me any evidence gathered over the last 40 years that indicates that any of that is correlated with outcomes, much less superior outcomes.
Right.
It just doesn't exist. So yeah. We all attend. We all see ourselves as improving. The data say we really don't get much better over the course of our career, which begs the question, why would I go to these trainings
Because if you want to renew your license, you're required to go.
Well, and that certainly is what I think most therapists – well, I think, David – the air conditioning has just come on. I don't know if it's.
I'm not hearing it.
You're not hearing it.
No.
Okay, perfect then.
Yeah.
Where were we?
And you're so lucky to have air conditioning, by the way.
Yeah.
We don't have it.
Well, and it's not even on downstairs here. It's on where I am. It's on the top floor. So yes, most of us are required to earn a certain number of continuing education credits, but I don't think that's why most go. Most clinicians say that they actually enjoy these events and that they learn things, and therein lies the problem. I think therapists want to improve. I think they want to help their clients. I have no doubt about that. I think the way we conceptualize that improvement and how we think about training doesn't serve those purposes.
Okay. So keep going.
Well, so then the question is how could we get better? And we were measuring the outcomes of tens of thousands of therapists around the world using some tools that we created back at the turn of the millennium. And we noticed once again that certain clinicians rose to the top. And we were trying to figure out what was it that led to those superior outcomes. We've known for some time that superior results are associated with engagement, and certain therapists are better at engaging their broad and diverse clientele that comes in. So we decided, since we weren't getting much guidance from looking at the empirical literature about how to improve. Oh, there were lots and lots of suggestions, I'll say that. But none of them, when you looked more closely at the data, were actually associated with improvement in outcomes. So, for example, right now the big topic du jour is trauma. Now, I'm not here to say that we should ever have ignored it the way we did, perhaps owing to all the way back to the very beginning of modern mental health treatments and Freud, who maybe decided that all of these traumatic things that people were reporting couldn't possibly be true, and the field sort of took that seriously and began assessing that. But if we're all learning trauma-informed therapy, shouldn't there be some evidence that it actually keeps people in therapy longer or improves their results? I can't see any evidence of that in real-world clinical settings. Maybe it's there, but I don't see any.
Even
after all this time, it's just assumed, and which is very interesting as well, because one of the key findings from the research on continuing education, traditional continuing education, you go to a workshop, you sit, you listen for 2 days, you get your certificate, is that therapists leave feeling more confident. And confidence, it turns out, is an anathema. It is the opposite of what you need to feel if you want to get better. In fact, what you need, according to researchers like Helene Nissen-Lee out of Norway, is professional self-doubt.
Well, I've always suffered from that, so I guess I'm in good shape.
So in any event, what we decided to do was begin – we started thinking about, well, who could we speak to? What professions could we speak to in an analogous kind of way that might give us clues about engaging people? And we thought about several. Salespeople are often quite engaging. Charismatic individuals and religious leaders can be quite engaging. But we ended up thinking about psychics and a group called mentalists. These are professional performers who I think many people believe can read your mind. You might see them in Vegas at a show or locally at a magic club. They're not working with props, cups and balls or handkerchiefs. These are folks with a pad and a pencil. In fact, there's a brand new show on TV of a mentalist that is called In and of Itself. Very impressive, very moving performances where this particular performer makes you feel like they know more about you than they should based on the limited interaction they've had with you.
I'm going to look for that.
It's a fabulous program, actually. And this particular performer is amazing at what he does.
And my experience with mentalists are, I think, on TV and shows like America's Got Talent, where they've had some incredible mentalists, but I've been skeptical about it because I've felt like, well, there's some kind of tricks that they're relying on. I don't know what they are, but I've not been able to deduce what those tricks could possibly be. But it's hard to believe that somebody could be on national TV and move ahead so unerringly. So are there like two divisions of mentalists? Are there ones who are essentially doing some kind of tricks versus others that are sort of more genuine?
I don't understand that distinction. Because for us, the issue is the outcome of it. How do you feel at the end of it? And what I'm hoping to do by studying this group of individuals is be able to connect more in a greater helping way with the clients that I'm working with. So I don't know how to answer that question.
Okay, I'll give you that these people are amazingly effective in recruiting interest, excitement, expectation.
Yes.
And so that's potentially, those are healing factors.
I think that engagement is, well, I don't think, the research indicates, this is the work of Orlinsky at the University of Chicago. Participation and engagement is the number one predictor of treatment outcome. Anything we do that improves client engagement is likely to have a net positive benefit on the outcome. Anything we do that gets in the way of client engagement is going to impact things negatively. Yeah. So I'm thinking we should be thinking about how can we engage a broader and diverse clientele.
Okay.
And much of what we do trains us to engage clients in a fairly narrow framework, what I would call the modern 21st century materialistic framework, that either it's real or it's a trick, or it's a placebo or it's true. It's your thoughts are real. And one of the things I will say is that if this is the distinction we're making as a field, well, then most of what therapists do, frankly, qualifies as superstition. And why is that? Because there's virtually no evidence that any of the techniques therapists use are in and of themselves curative or even necessary for the change process. But we spend big bucks to learn them. Does that make them a trick? Well, the question I think needs to be, did it help your client? Did they feel more engaged as a result? And the real criterion to judge whether or not we should be doing it is, does it fall within the parameters of what would be considered an ethical or a good practice by a community of our peers? And that's, I think, the bigger challenge with the whole message that the article, How Psychotherapy Lost Its Magic, faces.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think that in the article, you confess that you've, for a long time, maybe felt shy about moving in this direction, talking to psychics and mentalists for fear of professional censure. I have the impression somehow you've gotten past that.
Well, I think
probably not 100%, but
even in the introduction to the speech that you can find online, called Why Most Clients Who Could Use Therapy Don't Go. I think the title of it, it's The Missing Link. And even in that particular article, the person who introduces me, a good friend, mentions that I should be wary about talking about these things publicly. So I'm not taking a position on whether things are real or not, because I think this really misses the point. Let me give you an example. I have a beautiful piece of art that's above the desk that you can't see. It's painted by a Chinese artist. I purchased this in China. It's of a stone home with beautiful trees. When I walk in and look at this painting every day, as I do to my office, I don't think to myself, that painting's not real. The picture's not real. It's just a bunch of pigment on paper. I don't say that to myself. Instead, I'm moved by this piece of artwork. And I think in the field of therapy, we have for too long acted as though we can only do what a materialistic framework accepts and considers real and acceptable. This is why I think it's very dangerous for therapists to separate placebo from real factors in their work. Because, again, I can't find any evidence that all the things they believe are absolutely essential, whether it's confronting dysfunctional thoughts, initiating saccadic eye movements, laying on a couch. I can't find any evidence that any of these things are remedial to the disorder being treated. It is, therefore, from a medical point of view, simple superstition. Well, if it is, it certainly helps a lot of people. And really, probably a better way to think about this is that we work in the realm of culture and belief and meaning. And so I have to connect with something that the clients find meaningful. And huge percentages of the population do not share the strictly materialist point of view that the field seems obsessed with.
Let me cut in here to tell you about today's sponsor, Audible.com. I'm no stranger to Audible. They've been a go-to source for audiobooks for me for nearly as long as they've been in business. I've always got an audiobook going, mostly fiction, sometimes nonfiction. In fact, I just finished a special edition recording of Michael Connelly's first Harry Bosch novel, titled The Black Echo, read by Titus Welliver. I had already listened to most of the Harry Bosch series, but this one is special because the reader, Titus Welliver, is the actor who plays Harry Bosch on the Amazon Prime video series by the same name. That, plus the included interviews, makes it a special edition indeed. Audible always has great readers, but Titus makes this one extra special. Audible.com is no longer just audiobooks. Audible Plus, their newest plan, gives you full access to their popular Plus catalog, so that now you can listen all you want to thousands and thousands of popular audiobooks, original entertainment, and podcasts, including ad-free versions of your favorite shows and exclusive series. You'll also find guided fitness, meditation, and sleep tracks for better rest, all available to download and stream so you can listen anywhere on any device. Now, here's the offer. New members can try Audible Plus for 30 days for free. Just go to audible.com/shrink, or you can send a text to shrink and then enter 500. Once again, new members can try Audible Plus for 30 days for free. Just go to audible.com/shrink, or you can send a text to shrink and then enter 500. Now, back to the interview.
Yeah, and you make that point in your article that, you know, you give some percentages and all, and we've seen them in newspapers and other places, sometimes in the context of despair, that, oh my God, a large percentage of Americans are superstitious in regard to this or that. But I think the placebo is actually a positive thing. In the context of therapy, calling it a placebo is not helpful, of course.
Well, in fact, I think it's my colleague Bruce Wampold who points out in some very interesting research that the more structurally equivalent a placebo condition in a randomized trial is to the real treatment, the less difference there is in outcome between the two. Now, again, that either means that our framework or paradigm for thinking about what it is we do is wrong, or that we are strictly in the realm of placebo, which I think really denigrates the power of the work. Humans are a social species. We maintain that connection by language and meaning. And in the work that I'm doing, then I have to find out, well, what's meaningful to the other person? Mm-hmm. How can we connect? How can I work within what makes sense to you?
Okay. Yeah. I've long contended that psychotherapy has roots in shamanism as much or more as in science. And I was very interested in hypnosis in graduate school and have been in my career as well. And if you look into the history of mesmerism and so on, there's sort of a high road and a low road in terms of the history and the way it's reported. But Mesmer supposedly had somebody behind velvet curtains playing a violin and would wear a conical hat and, kind of present himself in some ways as a magician. And people came from all over Europe to get healed of one thing or another. And they did.
Yes. And mesmerism died. As you know, that was probably the first randomized trial in history was testing Mesmer. Benjamin Franklin came over, designed a study, et cetera. And the results of the study indicated that it really didn't have anything to do with magnetism.
Right.
It had to do with, they assumed, people's beliefs, which to me always seemed to miss the point.
Yeah.
Scads and scads of people were helped by this particular procedure.
Yeah, very prominent people, famous musicians, et cetera. Yeah. Mm.
And you see a rise in those kinds of therapies occurring now, so-called energy-based therapies.
Right.
And in the article, we talk about those energy-based therapies and say how for some time the field kind of scoffed at them. But then they did their own RCTs and they found out that actually people were helped by it. Now, our conclusion as a team was, well, of course they were helped by it. Virtually anything. In fact, get this. No model ever tested in psychotherapy has not worked. Get this. Many placebo conditions that were thought to be inactive therapies, when they were found to be as effective as the real treatment, became therapies. Interpersonal psychotherapy for depression is, for example, one of those. And there are similar treatments for the treatment of post-traumatic stress disorder, present-centered therapy. I didn't say person-centered. I said present-centered therapy emerged because it was developed as a placebo control, but it was as effective as the so-called trauma-informed therapies. Now it becomes a regular therapy. So to me, at least, this search for things that work like medicine, that psychotherapy is the talking equivalent of a pill, that it contains magical qualities that when swallowed are specifically remedial to the disorder being treated, it's not a very helpful way to think about our work. And
go ahead.
Well, what I was going to say is that this is what I think the shaman have known for generations.
Yeah.
That you have to provide.
What does this do to our professional requirements, conceptualization of evidence-based psychotherapy?
Well, the idea that there should be some evidence that what we do works is an interesting one. I have to say that no client treated with an evidence-based method, so-called evidence-based method, because the definition of evidence-based practice does not say use this method for that diagnosis. Evidence-based practice is made up. It's a verb. It's not a noun. It's not about using the treatment for the problem. It's an approach that you take to the work. the best available evidence in the context of client culture and preferences and clinical expertise. Those three elements interacting together is evidence-based practice, a verb. Unfortunately, I think our field's hunger for something that will help our clients, combined with a willingness to sell things to therapists to nourish that need, has caused this term to be used in a very twisted way, and it's turned it into evidence-based or empirically supported treatments approaches. So you hear this bandied about quite a bit in the field. I'm all for practice-based evidence, which means, and I started to say, no client who gets an evidence-based protocol and who's not helped by their therapist is going to say, well, at least it was evidence-based. They don't care. What they care about is, do I feel better? Am I better?
Yeah.
So from a practice-based evidence framework, what really matters to the individual client is, did I get what I came for? Am I actually helped? And there is a way to do that. Our team 20 years ago, as I said, began pioneering the use of routine outcome measurement, meaning that
I remember
at each visit,
from the workshop in 2006. That's, for me, that was the big takeaway, was get feedback from your clients regularly, and you develop some instruments to help facilitate that, as I recall.
We did, and now, you know, there are scores of randomized trials showing that when therapists use these measures, orient the care and finesse the care in response to client feedback, that outcomes are improved. So to me, that's an evidence-based practice. Mm-hmm. And we accomplish that by measuring the results of our work, which is, I think, where clients are really at.
Yeah.
I think that what will be the death knell in the whole evidence-based treatment movement, that you use this particular treatment for that problem, will be our rising acceptance of cultural and individual diversity. Because suddenly you now have to alter these methods to fit within various cultures. And at some point, they're not going to look anything like they were when they first began. Mm-hmm. What maybe we should do is simply help therapists embrace a variety of whatever they can do to be helpful to the people that they work with. And one of those things is to look at people's religious and spiritual beliefs and practices and begin to incorporate those in the work.
Yeah. I seem to recall in the article you mentioned that you consulted some of these mentalists and got a tarot reading for yourself.
Mm.
Can you share with us some of your personal experiences around that?
Took us a while, actually, to get and we started with the mentalists because they were professionals, and we thought that they might be more willing to speak with us, especially if we offered to pay them. It took longer to gain access to psychics and mediums, and I think in large part because their interaction with people like me, which are hardcore science people, has not been very positive over the last 100 years, actually since Houdini. And believe me when I say there are charlatans out there. There are people who will exploit you, who have the designation of a psychic or a medium or a reader. But let's be careful about casting stones in glass houses. All you have to do is look at the number of people who are defrocked within our field every year for egregious behavior, including, and I think, one of the largest frauds in the history of insurance fraud in the United States was committed by a mental health professional. So, you know, bad behavior crosses boundaries everywhere. So it took us time to win the confidence that our team wasn't coming in to debunk people. I wasn't interested in that because I don't share this paradigm that there is the real thing and then there's the placebo thing, that this is all fake. I was interested in the outcome delivered to the clients.
Yeah.
And I have to say that my experiences have been profound with some of these healers, and with others, you know, not so impressive. That sounds like our field, doesn't it? Sometimes you meet a clinician and it's like, wow, moved, changed, etc. And then there are some not so great experiences. But knowledgeable people, and especially knowledgeable about how to connect with others. In fact, we did a little follow-up study that I reported again in a speech that I gave at the Evolution of Psychotherapy conference, this is the Missing Link presentation. And in there, we surveyed people who had seen psychics, mediums, and therapists. And it turns out people preferred the psychics.
Yeah.
And actually found them more effective. Now, that didn't – it wasn't a race to me. It wasn't a horse race in which is better. That's crazy thinking. It's the same thing with, is CBT better than IPT or ACT? This is an uninteresting question, to me at least. My question was, well, how'd they do it? And what could we learn from those folks?
Yeah.
And a couple of things stood out. They were masters at relationship, at accommodating their work to the preferences and identity of the person that they were working with. And another key element was they were much more likely to give direct counsel and advice.
Huh. Yeah, something that we're taught to shy away from.
Yeah.
So yeah, a line in your article that I really think is telling, you said, a psychotherapy doesn't sing to the soul in the way that some of these other approaches, they make sense to the person, to the client, and fitting into their internal world, and something in them goes, yeah, that's what I'm talking about.
Yeah. And this is where our team thought our field could improve by widening its lens, moving beyond. Nowadays, everything in psychotherapy is either in your thinking, your behaving, your emotions, or your brain chemistry. It's pretty predictable. You can almost predict it if the therapist just tells you what their approach to therapy is.
Yeah.
Then you can tell how they're going to explain your particular problems. But human beings are bigger than that, and their experiences are wider than those four deeply materialistic ideas. They're also spiritual beings. They have a sense to them. So this is what we were looking to tap into. How is it that the mentalists, the psychics, the mediums tap into that?
And in your article, you said there are three processes that stood out to you: exploration, entering, and embodiment.
So in terms of taking steps towards becoming more magical and adopting a more magical point of view, these are stepwise processes. The first one is to simply explore, and we say in the article that that's what therapists do, I think, fairly naturally. They're curious creatures. They ask their clients about them and their lives. But it's a little bit like riding on the tour bus through a rich countryside or a country rich in history. You can see a lot from the windows. You can see a lot on YouTube. You don't even have to leave your house. You can explore a lot. Yeah. And for some people, that's enough. But most people want to leave their house. So the second step is a little bit bigger, and that means getting off the tour bus and actively entering into the client's reality. A good example of somebody who did this was the iconic psychiatrist Milton Erickson and his principle of utilization.
Right.
His story of working with a man who had been in a psychiatric hospital and thought himself to be Jesus Christ is a great example of that. Erickson didn't argue with the man. He put him to work doing carpentry work. Okay. You know, that's entering into people's reality and utilizing their particular beliefs.
Yeah.
I think therapists are comfortable with these first two stages because in both, you can still keep a foot in both camps. You can enter into the client's reality, even though it's different than yours, but you can bring with you what you believe. So you could use principles of CBT, for example, as you're entering another person's reality, so to speak, and simply using their language. The problem with this is that it can border on a spoonful of sugar, that we're just using people's beliefs to operate on them. And that leads to the last, which is embodiment, which is beginning to use the principles of magic and the occult and people's religious beliefs as making those part of the therapeutic work.
Okay, I think I need you to expand on that a little bit more.
Okay. So over the last, in fact, when we first started working with this one mentalist, and this was a person who he spent decades doing tarot readings, and he was amazing in terms of connecting around them. In the article, I relate how he brought out his tarot cards the very first time we met. And, you know, again, I didn't really know. My ignorance was on full display. So when he asked me, did I believe in this kind of thing, I talked about, well, archetypes and such. But and you're going to speak at such a vague and general level that it would apply to anybody. You know, I'd read all these things from the grad, explaining it all away. And then he said, would you be willing to try? I said, of course. He had me cut the deck into four cards, and he did a reading. And the stuff he said was not vague and not general and not applicable to everybody. He told me specific things about me, my family life, and history that were not publicly available and quite surprising and very moving. So it wasn't – I didn't feel exploited by this. I felt surprised. He got my attention, and then I wanted to learn more. I was curious. How did he do that? There was such a sense of intimacy through a deck of cards, really.
Yeah.
So
embodiment
really is about incorporating some of these ideas into your work. For me, that means that not within the realm of doing a professional hour, I've been doing a lot more tarot readings.
Conducting them yourself.
Yeah.
Yeah. Why not? Sure.
And especially generally only when people ask me, you know, they will have heard that I'm doing this. They will have heard from somebody else that I do this. And I have to say that the experiences have been, I think, rather profound.
You know, I went to a tarot reader conference and was invited to give a presentation, and I think talked about archetypes and things like that. But in the casual meeting around all of that and chatting with people who were making their living doing this, I was kind of – and this supports everything that you're saying. There are people there who are just – making really good money. I mean, big money. Giving these readings, and evidently they were just so good at it, you know, and often hired by powerful, influential people for guidance.
Yeah.
It makes you think.
Well, and this is, David, actually the dirty little secret. If you scratch most people just a little bit, even most mental health professionals, even those like me, they're saying, oh, you know, very scientific, and I am a very scientific guy. You scratch them a little bit, and they will begin to report these anomalous experiences.
Yeah.
Either, and they go from reading, having somebody do their tarot cards to actually hearing the voice of people who've passed on. Seeing ghosts. So these phenomena are there. Again, I'm not taking a position on their reality or not. I'm trying to connect with people in a way that they feel they can talk openly with me and that we can pursue what they want in a way that feels meaningful to them.
Yeah.
So I've noticed the same thing. There are people who are doing quite well reading tarot cards, and the person that you interviewed, Betty Friedson, whom I love, in fact, at a recent conference, I had a colleague and a friend, and I was telling him about our research project, and he's very skeptical. He's also somebody who knows a lot about magic. And he said, why don't you read my tarot card? So I put them out, and he was kind of like, yeah, well, you know, pretty general, pretty vague, all the traditional criticisms, which may be true. I don't claim to have some psychic gift. And I said, well, you know, don't talk to me, talk to Betty. So Betty didn't get out a set of tarot cards. She just kind of looked a little bit away and then started talking, like she was channeling something, some inner some conscious stream of information. And you could see my friend's face go pale.
Wow.
So I want to be able to do that more, not make my friends' faces go pale, but but connect with them in such a way that they go, oh my goodness, you know, wow, thanks for that. That really makes a difference.
Part of the lore is that we all have some ability to do this. Some people, as in other aspects of human beings, there may be a gradient, you know, that some people are born with a gift, but that we all have kind of a rudiment. Been in some workshops designed to explore that kind of thing, and you know, given some cold readings, and it's encouraging to discover that you've made some hits. But I've not been able to let go of my life as I know it and go off totally down that path.
What I do know is that most of us stay at a fairly rudimentary level in most of our skills. So I want to come back to the point you're mentioning, that whether or not each of us has this ability to tap into what Betty Friedson does so seamlessly. By saying that when we measure the outcomes of therapists and we track them over time, and our team published the largest study in the history of studies looking at therapists' professional development over time in terms of their outcomes. We did not find that therapists improved over time. In fact, we found they gradually worsened with time and experience. And this goes full circle to what we were starting with at the beginning of our conversation, which is over time, our behavior becomes automatic. We become proficient in an activity. The problem with automaticity, which you need so that you can direct your attentional resources elsewhere to learn new, other things. The problem with automaticity is we lose conscious control over our behavior. And at that point, you can't improve. As a species, however, we frequently conflate automaticity with confidence. So whether or not people have this skill or ability, and I certainly believe that people come into graduate school with varying levels of ability, I do believe, and where our work is focused on right at the moment, that we can improve our abilities through a process called deliberate practice. And deliberate practice is really about interrupting that automaticity, getting us to pause, rethink, and identify shortcomings in our current skills and abilities, so that we can then develop exercises and begin to work those weaker muscles. If you're going to take up the tarot, which when I did the presentation on how psychotherapy lost its magic at evolution, I think I had a number of people who missed my point, because some came up and they asked me, well, which tarot deck should I buy? And to me, that's a little bit like saying, well, should I do CBT or ACT? Which should I buy? And the answer is, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter which deck you use, because it's not about the deck. It's about the client and having some way of filtering the interaction, structuring the interaction so that it engages the person. And since 92% of Americans believe in some kind of larger, powerful force outside of us, I think you've got a lot of possibilities if you open up to that idea.
Yeah.
Whether it's through tarot cards or runes or reading the Bible together or prayer, all of these things are spiritual practices that might connect with people. But the way to improve them, if you have a particular interest, whether that's reading tarot cards, etc., is to identify when you don't connect, when there isn't meaningful, when the client doesn't find the process meaningful, so that I can finesse this a bit. What Brede Friedson has that I don't have are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of hours doing readings and thinking. She also worked with a masterful teacher named Herb Dewey, who would watch her do these readings and give her targeted feedback. Mm-hmm. And I think because she has this quality of ongoing reflection on her work, she's such a humble person. It doesn't come out. Sometimes you just don't see how much time she spends thinking and rethinking what she says and what she does in the room. Oh, even, no. I'm sure you noticed this, David. I'm sorry we're turning in this to a peep show about Betty. But if you look at the way she, if you look at the way she dresses, all of it conveys a certain warmth and being in the room that invites disclosure, engagement, etc. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I know she's thought about these things and she thinks about them on an ongoing basis.
I was tempted to ask her for some kind of a reading in the interview, but I didn't. Maybe I'll get back to her.
Yeah, you know, she does do a wonderful job. And I would say, not including Betty in this comment, that readers are a lot like therapists. There are a lot of them. Most of them are average, and there are a few really, truly exceptional ones.
Right.
So I've interviewed tarot card and psychics from Europe all the way to Australia. One experience that I had in Australia, in a town called Perth. I had a free Saturday over the weekend before I was teaching again on Monday, looked in the ads and found this psychic, went to see her, sat down and I said, "Do you want me to tell you anything?" She says, "No, I don't want you to tell me anything. I just want to have you hold these cards." These weren't traditional tarot cards. They were some other kind of tool. And then she began to lay them out. And then she said to me, "I see a small black dog." Now, my first thought was, meh, you know, small black dog. Most people are going to have a dog. Most dogs are black, brown, or white. So, you know, is it? Then she went on, and this dog is running on a beach. "Wait," she says, "it's not an ocean. It's a lake." And she says, "Oh, there's a boy. There's a boy that's running along after this." And I'm thinking, is she talking about me? Is she talking about somebody else? She then says, "It's not you, but he's related to you." And she says, are you here to talk to me about him?" And I was there to talk about my son. That was the question I went with. Now, how had she done this? I don't know if you maybe can't see, but the hair on the back of my neck is still standing up from this.
Sure.
And maybe if we would have recorded it, we'd be able to parse it and figure it all out. My guess is that much of this is operating at an automatic level for her. Pulling this apart is what our team has been doing in order to help therapists learn these kinds of engagement skills. And it's what we talk about in our latest book called Better Results, which is the book about deliberate practice. But it is, David, slow going. We see the end result of these performances. That's what I was seeing with this reader who I'm sure must do hundreds of readings per week. And by the way, I paid her as much for that 20-minute consult as you would pay a therapist for an hour. So, as you said.
And felt good about it.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And she also, as our study showed, this was post our study that I saw her, she also said, she also gave me very direct advice.
Did you follow the direct advice?
I did.
Was it helpful?
Yeah, it was helpful. It was quite helpful to me. Mostly what it did was relieve the worry that I had been thinking about when I called the number and set up an appointment.
Yeah. I've got some stories I'd love to share with you, but,
I'm sure.
Time's not going to allow that. I think the work that you're doing around this is wonderful, and it's pioneering work. And have you gotten any arrows in your back as a result of being a pioneer?
Surprisingly, no. I really haven't, and that may be just a sign that this particular stuff that we've written isn't all that well known. Although the article that you've kindly referred to in the Networker, which you can access for free, Rich Simon at the Networker made it available. It was one of the conditions of our agreeing to publish it there. So you can go there, How Psychotherapy Lost Its Magic, Psychotherapy Networker, and you can read it. It's been read something like 60,000 times, which is one of our most read articles we've ever. If you contrast that, by the way, David, with one of our research articles, and I'm not exaggerating here, most of our research articles, you can find sites that will track how many times it's been accessed, 150, 200 reads.
Right.
So the reach here is big, which suggests to me that therapists know. And I hope you know that I'm not saying that what therapists should do is run out and buy a tarot deck or throw science away. I come to this via science, and in many ways, we're in the same place that we were over 120 years ago, because the founding figure that I consider the founding figure of talk therapy in the field, not Freud, but William James, the person who had the first psychological laboratory in the world, not, as the licensing exam says, William Wundt.
Yeah.
William James was investigating all of these phenomena and very curious about them. And I think they're tightly related to the so-called talking cure, that these folks created a sense of intimacy and connection.
Yeah. In relation to deliberate practice, in a previous interview with Tony Rosmier, I don't know how to say his name.
Rosmier, yeah.
Yeah, and John Fredrickson also.
Mm.
I don't know if you were influenced by them or they were influenced by you. What's the relationship there? You know their names.
Yeah, Tony became quite interested in the work we were writing about deliberate practice back in 2007. So in 2007, we published our first article called Super Shrinks, which is another one. If you type in Super Shrinks, Scott Miller, it'll come up on the web. And we were trying to explain why some therapists were better than others. And we happened quite magically, actually, stumbling upon the work of a Swedish psychologist by the name of K. Anders Ericsson, who talked about how people in most professions actually spend their entire lives generally more time at work than they do with their home, family, or other avocations, and yet remain relatively average in their performance. Pretty disconcerting finding. But within that group, there are some who rise to the top, and his explanation was they engage in more deliberate practice. What does that mean? That means identifying areas of weakness and then constantly reaching for performance objectives just beyond your current abilities. So we were writing about that in 2007. I think Tony became very enthused about that. His own book came out, I think, in, don't hold me to this, 2015 maybe. And he had been quite influenced by Fredrickson's research within a dynamic, psychodynamic tradition of psychotherapy, and has been writing about the application of DP within that tradition.
Yeah. Yeah. So there's a community of thought gathering around this. work. And I think it's admirable. It's also very challenging, I imagine, given our human tendency to want to avoid looking at our weaknesses rather than to work on them.
So can I give an analogy here?
Yeah.
And when we first started, this is all connected. When we first started became interested in deliberate practice, my colleagues and I each chose a different area that we, outside of the field of therapy, where we try to apply what we were learning. So my colleague Suzanne Bargman, a Danish psychologist, she decided to take up singing. She has a very interesting interview with on a podcast. Oh, I'm going to forget the name of these economists. There's two economists. It'll come to me. Where she traces the evolution of the improvement in her singing as a result of spending time with deliberate practice. I decided to pick up close-up sleight of hand. So I started visiting a local magic shop where actually Jay Marshall, who was a famous magician during the – on Ed Sullivan many, many times during the 60s. He'd owned that shop. His son, Sandy Marshall, now owns the shop. And so I started doing close-up sleight of hand. Now, here's what I noticed. And here's what, thankfully, because I was there as a psychologist trying to study deliberate practice, not really to learn magic. And the manager of that store used to say, magic stores would not survive if all therapists knew the secret to magic. And I'd say, what is that? He'd say, practice. Because what ends up happening in most cases is people come, they buy a trick, they try it out, it works a little bit, and then what do? They go back and buy another trick, and then another trick, and then another trick. And the result is their performance always stays at the same level. It's just the trick that changes. He says the real secret is perfecting that same trick so that it has a bigger, more profound impact. Our field of therapy is the same. Every year there are new tricks, and we move laterally through those tricks. So CBT, ACT, EMDR, cognitive process. I mean, there's always a new trick that promises that if you do this, you'll finally be therapeutic, as if buying a trick will make you a magician. So I think it's more that shortcuts are easily available. Not so much that we're unwilling to look at our mistakes, but that there's always going to be somebody there to say, here's how you do it. Here's the shortcut. And that's happening, by the way, in the world of deliberate practice. You, I think, say, and rightly so, that deliberate practice is hard work. But mostly what it is tedious and frustratingly slow. Think of those Olympic athletes who are training for 4 years to shave off milliseconds.
Yeah.
Or millimeters from their performance.
Yeah.
Very few are willing to do that because most of us are willing to settle for proficiency or good enough.
Uh-huh.
So, and if I can sell you something, I say, oh, you know, you don't have to put in all that time, that hard work. I'll show you how to shave off. I'm going to sell you this new swimsuit. Remember this controversy in the Olympics a couple years ago? I'm going to sell you this new swimsuit, make you swim faster. So I think this is where we end up in trouble. And you're going to see it in the DP area as well. Somebody will say, all you have to do is watch this video, learn this skill, and then you'll be better. But DP is not about proficiency. It's about reaching for performance objectives just beyond your current ability. And for me, that's what the psychics were doing. That's what the mediums were doing. You know, I don't want somebody like Abigail to leave my office going, Scott Miller did not get it. He did not get it. If what she wants is to know that her daughter is okay, then I want to do something in my office that helps her leave with that assurance.
This has been a delightful conversation, and hopefully there's more to say about deliberate practice, because I'm very likely going to invite you back at some point to go into that in some depth. But I really want to thank you for your generosity and being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
David, I really appreciate this opportunity, and I hope what I've said is understandable, and I look forward to talking again.
I think today's guest, Dr. Scott D. Miller, is paradoxically a real pioneer. Why paradoxically? Well, on the one hand, he's a stalwart champion of the scientific method. On the other hand, he's subtly undermining the narrow doctrinaire stance that psychotherapy training and practice has adopted in its quest to appear scientifically acceptable. He's the camel with its nose under the tent. I'm just doing science here, but let's get back to our early beginnings with William James and his curiosity about the varieties of religious experience. Let's admit that our psychotherapy enterprise has lost its way with its obsession about one technique over another and lost our customer base in the process. To me, he's conservatively radical. His work really speaks to me because I've struggled to unite this split in myself over the years. I sometimes wonder if my graduate school training was good for me. I went into it feeling like there was something in my essence that would make for good psychotherapy. If I could just hang out with people, be myself, and find a way to connect. You've probably heard me say before, only a little tongue in cheek, that I graduated from the Academy of Doubt. Academic training schools you in learning to question everything. That's excellent training for self-protection, I suppose, but maybe not for becoming a nurturer, a healer. In his article, he quotes Bruce Wampold as writing, quotes, "Decades of psychotherapy research have failed to find a scintilla of evidence that any specific ingredient is necessary for therapeutic change." Close quote. Scott Miller writes, "We hope to find clues to the success of super shrinks by investigating other disciplines in which engagement plays a central role in effectiveness. Among the many possibilities, such as sales, marketing, management, medicine, one specialty stood out. A group of entertainers known as mentalists, whose work is characterized by the ability to create an experience of intimacy and understanding, often within seconds of meeting." Close quote. His team's research has found three processes that super shrinks are able to excel at: exploration, entering, and embodiment. In our conversation, Scott sounded a note of optimism, I think, in his observation that society is forcing us toward embodied engagement as we come to terms with all our various subcultures. I'm thinking instead of one size fits all, we need to embrace the idea that blacks may be best served by black therapists, gays by gay therapists, and so on down the line. In the interview, Scott hinted that he had some profound experiences working with mentalists, psychics, and tarot readers. I asked him if he could share one or more of those personal experiences with us. Initially, it looked like he slipped the question and would not feel comfortable going there in this public forum. But then he did share the story about consulting a card reader in Perth who blew his mind speaking to concerns he had about his young son at the time. And he even shared that he has offered himself up as a tarot reader when pressed to do so. I wish we could get together over a beer and just swap stories. I think we'd have a lot to share. He's such an articulate and accomplished guy that I felt a little intimidated, but I think in a different time and place we could get past that. I'm glad that we were able to get as much rapport going as we did. As he indicated, his article from the Psychotherapy Networker on how psychotherapy lost its magic is readily available if you will Google it.
I strongly encourage you to do so. I loved his sharing that it got something like 60,000 hits, whereas more academic writings get far fewer. And I'm sure that many of those 60,000 hits came from psychotherapists who resonated with his call to shake off the shackles imposed by our profession, or maybe by ourselves.
Hi, Dr. Dave. I just wanted to share my experience of listening to Shrink Wrap Radio and why I decided to make a donation to the podcast. I learned about your show through a course I was taking with the Zur Institute. I'm not sure if you were being interviewed or someone else was being interviewed, but somehow Shrink Wrap Radio was mentioned, and I decided I had to check it out for myself. When I went to your site, I found over 600 podcasts on all these different areas focusing on human behavior and psychology. When I listened to your interviews, what I liked most was how it just felt like it was two good friends having a candid conversation about whatever topic it was that you were covering. There's often a sincerity that seems to come through in your interviews with your guests. And I guess as a listener, it makes me feel included or part of the process. When I listen to the show, it feels like I'm just there with you as you guys are talking. I also really like how at the end of the show, you'll just reflect on what it was like to interview that guest, or maybe mention something that just couldn't get covered because of time constraints. I think about how you're a one-man show, all the time and resources that it must take to do all this. I've never done a podcast before, and I don't know what it takes in terms of all the pieces that have to come together to get this going every week. I know you have to find a guest. That takes time. I know that you have to research their background, read their book, or read their articles so that you're prepared. That takes time. And, of course, do the interview. That takes time. And then lastly, upload the recording or the podcast so that we, the listeners, get to enjoy it. That takes time. I also imagine that there's so much more to doing a podcast that meets the eye in terms of time and resources that has to take place every week so that we get the pleasure of listening all that you do. I get so much from your shows. I learn a lot. I imagine many of your listeners have a very similar experience, if not all of them. And I think about how this show covers so much content that benefits the online community, whether or not they're in the field. Students can learn a lot from this show. Practitioners, people in the field, benefit from this show and likely feel more connected to the field by listening to all the content. And I just think people in the community can benefit from this. I often share the content or forward a podcast if I think it's relevant to a colleague or to a client because it focuses on something that we happen to cover in session, or even to family and friends. And because of all that I receive, and I think the community in general gets from these online podcasts, I just wanted to contribute in whatever way that I could to support the work that you're doing. It's a real pleasure to listen to your shows, and they really keep me company through all sorts of things. I've listened to you on long drives, you and your guests on, you know, different types of topics that you might be covering. I've listened to you on the treadmill. And I suspect that my experience is pretty similar to a lot of your other listeners, too. You and your guests are kind of accompanying us in whatever it is that we're doing on a day-to-day basis. And I guess for all those reasons, and probably others that I haven't said, I just wanted to support what you're doing so that we, the listeners, all of us, can continue to benefit from your podcasts. I look forward to listening to many, many more. Thank you so much for all that you do.
Thank you, Dr. Kimberly Tangen. I thank you for all your appreciation for all that goes into producing these podcasts and for your ongoing donations. And thanks to new donor Miko Karhulati, I think, at the Berlin Gestalt Institute for your new ongoing donation. Your name is now on the Shrink Wrap Radio Honor Roll for 2021 and hopefully beyond. Before I go, I'd like to share a listener email with you. And this is from Hugh Marr. And Hugh Marr writes, I am a clinical psychologist in the Washington, D.C. area. My wife Paula and I live in the Maryland suburbs. Paula ran a large program for Walter Reed. She's an art therapist, and the kids were all in school here in Maryland. Years ago, after a career in community mental health, I got a great job as director of a partial hospital program serving clients with severe mental illness and substance abuse. Unfortunately, that job was in the Virginia suburbs, 37 miles away, an hour commute on a good day, and there weren't many good days. After 14 years as partial hospital director, I went into private practice, joining a group where I had contacts, and I knew the resources, that is, in Virginia, still a 33-mile commute. If I left either home or work in rush hour, I would double my commute time. If I worked late, I had to deal with road construction. Once Paula and my son Chris were driving and saw a car parked on the side of the road. That looks like Dad's car, said Chris. Indeed it was. I had gotten tired and pulled off to catnap. It wasn't until COVID and telehealth that I was finally able to close my Virginia office in order to commute up half a flight of stairs to the spare bedroom. I tell you all this because the way I coped with all that commute all those years was by listening to Shrink Wrap Radio. You've always done a fine job of interviewing, in the tradition of Studs Terkel. And I always learned something from the intriguing guests you invited. It made an onerous commute tolerable, even an occasional delight, and probably saved my life on more than one especially weary occasion when I would have otherwise lapsed into unconsciousness. The other thing I did on those long drives was to hone all those years of psychotherapy into my own understanding of how therapy works and when it doesn't, and how the myriad of seemingly competing approaches each contributes to a larger understanding. The result was my 2020 book, A Clinician's Guide to Foundational Story Psychotherapy, Co-Changing Narratives, Co-Changing Lives. It was my first foray into expressing my own understandings for clinicians gleaned from a blessedly long and varied career. And he notes, I'd previously written an introduction to archetypes and what stories you are living with Jungian author Carol Pearson. Well, I know that book well. That's quite a kudo. He goes on to say, as thanks for the years of ideas and enjoyment, I would very much like to mail you a copy. Could you send me your mailing address? With warm appreciation, Hugh Marr. Well, I have to say he won me over, and he's going to be a guest in early July. I love appreciation, don't you? I think Hugh's book will be a good follow-on to today's interview with Dr. Scott D. Miller, Story as a Unifying Element Among the Various Therapy Brands. So with that, let's wrap it up for today. My thanks to the ever-industrious and brilliant Dr. Scott D. Miller for sharing his work on what makes psychotherapy most effective. We'll be speaking to him again some months down the road to get more details on his work on deliberate practice. My next interview will be with Dr. Malik Boykin, a.k.a. Malik Starks. He is the first Black professor in the Department of Cognitive, Linguistic, and Psychological Sciences at Brown University. And he is described as a dope hip-hop artist. Currently, Starks has joined forces with producer Stefan Alexander, a theoretical physics professor at Brown University. The results include the jazzy Afro-Caribbean-styled single Dancing for Freedom alongside vocalist Kanjia. The song Dancing for Freedom has over 500,000 plays on TikTok and is streamed on all streaming platforms. I expect he will be an inspiring revelation. So until then, please remember to be kind to yourself and others.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.